This is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Wednesday, November 23rd of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, we'll hear about what neuroscientists call structured reflection and what it has to do with communicable disease during holiday gatherings. Chris Moore will have his weekly commentary, Make Them Hear You. And then herbalist Brigitte Mars will bring us her regular Wednesday feature, Naturally. A BBC News update is at the bottom of the hour. Then it's the Hightower Lowdown. After that, we're going to air the Thanksgiving edition of The Children's Hour from Kids Public Radio. Then at 9:30, Cameron Henderson will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all still ahead this morning, but first, a look at the headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
Public defenders for the suspect accused of killing five people and wounding several others at a Colorado Springs LGBTQ plus nightclub indicate in court papers that the suspect is non-binary and uses the pronouns they and them. The suspect is scheduled to appear at an advisement hearing today at the El Paso County District Court in Colorado Springs. The suspect's appearance will be virtual from the El Paso County Jail. The court papers, according to the Associated Press, did not elaborate on the suspect's gender identification. News details are emerging on the suspect's background. According to media reports yesterday, the suspect's grandparents, who were his legal guardians, petitioned a Texas court for a name change to protect the then 16-year-old suspect from a birth father with a criminal history. The name change petition, according to the Associated Press, was also within months of the suspect being the target of online bullying. The suspect is currently facing 10 preliminary charges, including first-degree murder and committing a bias-motivated crime. Additional charges may be added, including assault and attempted murder. The suspect was transferred from the hospital to the El Paso County Jail yesterday, according to Colorado Springs Police. The suspect was treated after being tackled and beaten by nightclub patrons who have been credited with preventing further loss of life. State health officials say the continued rise in respiratory syncytial virus, otherwise known as RSV, and other respiratory illnesses is straining the capacity of the state's hospitals, especially those with pediatric-specific services, such as Children's Hospital of Colorado and the Rocky Mountain Hospital for Children. As of Monday, the state only had two pediatric ICU beds available. Officials from the state health department provided an update and presented data showing both hospitalized RSV and influenza cases are higher this week than in years past. The chief medical officer for Children's Hospital Colorado says his hospital is still operating at 100% full capacity, along with long emergency room wait times. During Monday's briefing by the state health department, state epidemiologist Dr. Rachel Hurley gave a rundown of the trends caused by influenza, COVID-19, and RSV, what some are calling a triple demic.
We continue to see an increasing trend as far as an influenza and COVID-19 go. For RSV, we also continue to see pretty high levels of circulation, including high levels of hospitalizations in our pediatric population.
Health officials also remarked how age is a factor for impacts by the respiratory viruses.
We're seeing the majority of hospitalizations from COVID-19 right now are occurring in adults. What we're seeing with RSV is the vast majority of those hospitalizations are occurring in our pediatric population.
State health officials also noted those hardest hit by RSV are infants under 6 months of age, and the risk of hospitalization greatly diminishes after 5 years of age. Regional Transportation District General Manager Deborah Johnson told Aurora City Council Tuesday that the agency will reopen a four-mile segment of the light rail R line next week once RTD meets regulatory and safety milestones. On September 21st, an RTD train derailed going around a curve in Aurora, resulting in the segment's closure. The derailment caused injuries to three passengers and damage to a power pole. The segment near Exposition Avenue and Sable Boulevard has been problematic for RTD as a light rail operator in 2019 approached the same section too quickly, causing a similar derailment. The agency says RTD now has a corrective action plan approved by the Colorado Public Utilities Commission, which includes more operator training and methods to slow the trains. Johnson told Aurora elected officials it would be up to the Colorado Public Utilities Commission to release the report that investigated the causes of the September incident. The lesser prairie chicken is joining the list of threatened species in Colorado and the list of endangered species in states to the south. KGNU's John Kellen has more.
Federal wildlife officials say the decline of the lesser prairie chicken is a sign that native grasslands and prairies are in trouble. Protecting the bird, said the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Amy Luters, can protect the environment, too. Advocates say they're relieved by the new designation, which reinstates the 2014 threatened species status. That was overturned after oil and gas industry lawsuits. Critics of the reinstated designation say it means farmers and ranchers are losing more land use control. They argue that voluntary efforts to conserve land and protect the lesser prairie chicken habitat are working. The lesser prairie chicken population has declined significantly. Scientists believe one reason for that is land development by agriculture and the oil and gas industry. But Zach Riley of the Colorado Livestock Association says new protections for the bird are a case of environmental groups going after industries using the Endangered Species Act. While the lesser prairie chicken is now a threatened species in Colorado, Kansas, and Oklahoma, it will have a more restrictive endangered species listing in New Mexico and Texas. For KGNU, I'm John Kellen.
Staffing shortages are delaying the opening of the Fort Collins Seasonal Overflow Shelter for individuals experiencing homelessness. According to the Fort Collins Coloradan, city officials expected the overflow shelter at 1117 North Mason Street would open on November 11th, with its operation continuing through April. The city is partnering with the Fort Collins Rescue Mission to operate the additional bed shelter. Seth Forwood, senior director of the rescue mission, told the Coloradan that the organization still needs to find three employees to begin operations. Forwood also said they are unsure how they can open the shelter without the necessary staff. The state health department is offering grants to communities disproportionately affected by pollution as a way to defray costs for technical assistance used by the entities when they want a better say in rulemaking hearings and permit proceedings. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment says the maximum grant allocation is $250,000, and the agency plans on awarding up to 10 grants in the spring. Interested communities and nonprofits must submit an application by February 3rd. More information is available at the State Health Department's webpage titled Environmental Justice Grants Program. For today's weather, the National Weather Service says there will be increasing clouds with highs in the upper 40s, low 50s. Winds could gust as high as 33 to 34 miles per hour. The National Weather Service also says elevated fire conditions will develop over portions of the plains this afternoon due to gusty winds up to 40 miles per hour behind a cold front. Tonight in the late evening hours, there is a 20 to 30% chance of snow, with lows ranging from 24 to 26 degrees. The current temperature in Boulder is 31 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Spending more time with family is a big part of Thanksgiving for many people. But since 2020, family gatherings have been occurring under the shadow of communicable disease. And it's not just COVID this year. There's also a surge in RSV, a respiratory virus primarily affecting young children, and the flu is back with a vengeance. But this so-called triple-demic comes amid widespread pandemic fatigue. A new study shows that structured reflection can reduce risk to others. CU Boulder's Leif Van Boven co-authored the report. He is a professor of psychology and neuroscience and joins me to discuss the findings. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
So start off by explaining what you mean by structured reflection and the role it plays in risk scenarios.
Structured reflection is a term that we use to refer to a very simple process where we invite people to reflect reflect on their personal values in the context of a particular decision. And so we structure that reflection to kind of highlight what the relevant considerations are. So to be more concrete about that, if you are considering attending a large social gathering, if you're considering having social contact with other people, in these times of transmissible diseases, especially by respiratory transmission, we might ask ourselves how much we care about the fact that we might negatively impact other people's health. So we think about, you know, how much benefit would we get from attending this event? And we think about whether simply being there might negatively impact other people. And the point is not to tell people what to do, but to help them become more aware of and mindful of their values and to better see how their behavior might reflect those values.
Now, you're a local scientist, but can you give listeners an idea of the scope of your study and some of the more standout details?
Sure. So we conducted actually a series of studies across countries from around the world. So we worked with collaborators in Korea, Sweden, Israel, the United Kingdom, Italy, Brazil. And we were interested in understanding these different contexts because at the time that we conducted the studies, these different countries had different experiences with the pandemic. Different countries had different policies in place that were more or less restrictive. And so we wanted to see if these simple procedures would generalize across all of these different contexts and across all of these different cultures. And we found a couple of things that are pretty striking. The first one is that when we ask people to reflect on their values in terms of whether they should impose risks on other people, there was a very clear and consistent response across all of these cultures that people strongly believe that they should not impose health risks on other people. That includes other friends in their social network, other family members, other patrons at a business. People generally share this value. And it was really quite remarkable that we saw that consistently across different countries, but also, you know, within our own country, which we sometimes view as pretty fractious and being pretty divided in the values that people have. But at least on this value, people very much agreed that they should not impose risks on other people. So then the question is, well, if we believe that we should avoid, you know, imposing health risks on other people, are there ways that that realization might influence the decisions that we make? And that's where we ask people to consider these different scenarios about whether they should attend a social gathering. And what we do is we simply manipulate as experimentally when we ask people to engage in this reflection. So sometimes we ask people right before they tell us what they would do in these scenarios, and other times we ask them afterward. And the key finding is that when we ask people before making a decision to reflect on their values about whether they should impose risks on other people, they say to themselves, no, I don't think I should impose risks on other people. And having made that realization, they then say they're less likely to attend these social gatherings. Now, importantly, and this, I don't want to lose sight of this fact, these are difficult decisions for people to make, right? I think as we all recognize throughout the course of the pandemic, being isolated is safer with respect to the pandemic, but it comes at a real social cost and it comes at a real economic cost. And as we continue to navigate through these difficult situations, we really need to grapple with how to weigh those different costs and benefits. And so what we find in our studies is that for some people, they say that, you know, in this case, the benefit of being together with my family for Thanksgiving, for example, is really worth a lot. We've really been, you know, suffering these past couple of years. And so it's really, really beneficial. And for those people, they're not likely to cancel a Thanksgiving gathering. They recognize that it's important not to impose risks on other people, but they also recognize that it's important to maintain social contact. And so it's not that we're telling people what the right answer is, but really helping them to reflect on the different trade-offs that are inherent in these kinds of choices.
I wanted to take this opportunity to ask about the combination of your fields. You teach psychology and neuroscience. Are those long separate fields starting to merge more as our understanding of brain chemistry evolves?
Yeah, absolutely. So the field of psychology has really expanded and incorporated insights and advances from the field of neuroscience. And there are a handful of departments around the country, around the world, really, where psychology and neuroscience are integrated in the same department. The University of Colorado Boulder is actually pretty unique in that regard. And so students in our major can take classes that kind of address traditional psychology questions, like the impact of social context, the development of personality, the basic way that people learn and remember things. But they do that through the lens of the underlying structure and function of the brain and neuroscience considerations more generally. So it is really both a unique opportunity for students, but then also for faculty. So we have really fun discussions where, you know, someone like me might talk about survey-based studies, and then someone else will say, well, that aligns with what we've learned when we've, you know, scanned people's brains as they're making these really difficult decisions. So anyone who's interested in both fields should definitely consider our department.
And lastly, what are you doing for Thanksgiving and why?
We have a relatively large group. So my parents live in the Seattle area, and our daughter lives there as well. So our daughter, my parents, my son, and his wife are coming from Salt Lake City. And so in our case, we have reflected on the different values. Everyone is vaccinated and boosted and in relatively good health. And so we know the risks will be there, but they'll be relatively low. And it's been too long since we have all been together. And so having weighed those risks, we are getting together for a nice family Thanksgiving. And we will do so with the windows open and the air ventilated.
My guest today has been Leif Van Boven, Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at CU Boulder. Thank you for joining me today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine. We'll be right back after this quick break. We go now to Chris Moore's weekly commentary, Make Them Hear You.
Make Them Hear You.
This is Make Them Hear You with ideas how you can have your voice heard before Congress. Since the turn of the century, newspaper subscriptions have dropped by 50% from over 60 million households to around 30 million now. Countless rural areas have become news deserts where there is no one to report on corruption among local politicians. The journalists who do still have jobs see their work pirated by social media and other internet-based news sources. The Bipartisan Journalism Competition and Protection Act, or JCPA, Senate Bill 673 or H.R. 1735, seeks to remedy this situation. The Senate passed this bill out of committee with strong bipartisan support on September 22nd. The JCPA will hold big tech firms accountable for how they will use newspaper-based stories. Big tech will have to pay local newspapers and reporters for the use of their content. Not only does big tech not pay fairly to the news sources they pluck information from, they also use algorithms designed to keep each of us in our own separate information bubble to create clickbait for their advertisers. And speaking of advertisers, 70% of all advertising dollars now go to the internet. Since news outlets like local newspapers have gone to a digital presence and have much bigger audiences than ever, ad revenues for them have plummeted. How will the JCPA address these issues? First, they will require big tech to negotiate with local journalism outlets in good faith. The bill sunsets after 6 years, which the traditional journalism industry says should be enough to rectify the unfairness of our current anti-competitive environment. The terms arranged between tech platforms and local papers also controls how the local press spends the funds they receive. The organization Public Knowledge, however, opposes the bill because, quote, the bill also allows publishers to restrict Google and Facebook from linking to their news stories, ultimately limiting the public's access to credible information online. This bill is also a threat to content moderation. The JCPA allows publishers to sue Facebook or Google for taking down content that the platforms find offensive or contrary to their community standards. And with the most recent amendment proposed by Senator Ted Cruz, harmful misinformation and hate speech will be even harder to police under this bill, and that is by design. The JCPA will not save local journalism. Instead, it will make a few billionaires even wealthier at the expense of a healthy and open internet and information environment for all of us. Close quote. This is a complex one. The Senate has until the end of the year to vote on the JCPA. The Denver Post, which obviously has a vested interest in the passage of this bill, has called it, quote, one of the most important checks and balances we have against corporate power and government corruption, close quote. If you have thoughts on the complex Journalism Competition and Protection Act, or JCPA, Senate Bill 673 or H.R. 1735, you can contact your representative and senators. This is Chris Moore with Make Them Hear You.
It's now time to check in with herbalist Brigitte Mars, who brings us her weekly episode of Naturally.
Greetings and welcome to Naturally. This is Brigitte Mars. You've probably heard that many people gain like an average of 8 pounds between Thanksgiving and New Year's. Well, 'tis the season to be jolly, of course, but here's a few ideas on how you can have a healthier Thanksgiving. The most important thing is to be thankful, for despite whatever's difficult in your life, remember to count your blessings and make that an important part of getting together. So when it comes to shopping, of course, we get to vote with our dollars. So if you eat turkey, here's your chance to support organic farmers, to do things that are antibiotic and hormone-free, and support the farmers that are really doing a better job. And of course, there's so many vegan alternatives as well, where you won't even miss the turkey. Cranberry sauce out of a can is really not that great. Cranberries are in the same family as blueberries, and they help to prevent bacteria from adhering to the bladder wall. I love to buy cranberries this time of year, and I make a raw cranberry sauce simply by blending cranberries, grapes, and dates with some orange juice in the food processor and serving it. It is so good. Pumpkin pie is another tradition, and pumpkins are a member of the same family that zucchini and winter squash are. Even cucumbers are all in the Cucurbitaceae family. And pumpkins are really high in beta carotene, and it's not hard to make pumpkin pie yourself. And you can sweeten it rather than using sugar. I like to use coconut sugar. Well, potatoes, you know, potatoes have become quite the GMO white starchy blob. I like to use blue or red potatoes. But another alternative to potatoes is to make mashed rutabaga. Rutabaga is high in anti-cancer compounds, sulforaphane, and you can peel them, boil them, and mash them up, and it's super good and nourishing and gives you a lot more nutrition than, say, white potatoes. Stuffing, well, so many people are finding out that letting gluten out of their diet can be a boon to their health. So you might want to try looking into a gluten-free stuffing and using lots of nuts in there, like walnuts or pecans toasted. And of course, sage and rosemary are wonderful digestive aids. They help protein digestion. So no matter how you choose to spend Thanksgiving and who you choose to spend it with, the important thing is to be grateful for all the blessings. And I'm thankful for you. Thank you for joining me, Brigitte Mars, for 40 years on Naturally.
That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Special thanks to Stacey Johnson, John Kellen, Alexis Kenyon, Chris Moore, and Brigitte Mars for their contributions to today's program. A reminder that if you'd like to share a comment with KGNU, call us at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesday mornings at 8:25 during the Morning Magazine. Stay tuned for the Hightower Lowdown and then a Thanksgiving special from the Children's Hour. That's coming up after these news headlines from the BBC.